is the Victorian Country Hour with Warwick Long on ABC Radio Victoria.
A very good afternoon to you. The future of the dairy industry is being examined in finer detail today. Leaders from across the dairy industry are all meeting with the Agriculture Minister to outline the future of the industry. It has been in decline for a long period of time. The last report, though, said there was some green shoots of growth there. So what is the wider outlook for this industry? Who's getting in? And more importantly, how many are getting out? You will hear from Agriculture Minister Murray Watt on what he has heard today on this program. If you have a question for Murray Watt, you can send it to us, 0467 842 722. 0467 842 722. We'll also go to Farm World, which is, of course, on at Lardner Park in Warragul. Fiona Broom is there. She'll take you to Farm World shortly on the program. And we've got a whole lot more coming up. In fact, we've got an answer on yesterday's story on the Country Hour, and I'll update you next.
The Victorian Country Hour with Warwick Long on ABC Radio Victoria.
So yesterday on the Country Hour, we told you how a Kundrook dairy farmer who helped coordinate work to protect the town from floodwater during the devastating October 22 floods says contractors who did that work are yet to be paid by the state government. Two contractors worked with local residents to build up a levee bank so floodwater could be pumped out of the township. Here's Angus Verley speaking to Skeeter Verhey about the efforts to get payment for these contractors. That's now dragged on to 17 months.
They dropped everything to get there. They managed that. They did the work that you needed to be done to protect the town with the understanding that they would be paid by the government, essentially. But now we're 18 months on and they haven't been paid?
Yeah, after we went through the proper channels, which we were told were go through the ICC that was set up, then get it assessed by SES assessed it. I was under the impression that we could go in and do those works. The technical side of it, whether we across the T's and dot the I's properly, well, you know, you just presume that when someone says that, yeah, we need to get these works done from a couple of channels, then it's right to go. So we did that with these contractors, and after these guys had come in and done their works, it just seemed to drag on that there was no funds there, and yet all the other works around the town are being completed and cleaned up and done. And we're just trying to work out where it fits for us. You know, Christmas this year when we had a very heavy rain event again, and, you know, it looked like we're going to go back to this again, it would have been quite embarrassing to have to go. Well, they probably wouldn't have come if we had to ring these earthworks guys and say, look, our local guys, we need you again. And, you know, their fuel time and labour hadn't been sort of looked upon or, you know, sorted with the first event going back 18 months or more ago.
So that's a little of Skeeter Verhey, which we heard on the Country Hour yesterday, talking about the problem. The contractors did the work. 17 months later, they were still waiting to be paid. Whilst we've got an update on this story, Vic SES has sent us a statement. I can read it to you now, and I quote, Vic SES is aware of a small number of outstanding local invoices which have been submitted relating to works in Gunawarra Shire during the 22-23 floods. Invoicing and approvals for these works did not, in this instance, follow Vic SES's normal protocols, and the invoices were ultimately overlooked. Vic SES apologises to the local contractors for the oversights and delay. The invoices are now being paid in full. There you go. So those contractors will now be paid. The key bit of that statement from Vic SES, the invoices are now being paid in full. An actual answer and a result, a change in that. That statement goes on further, and I'll read you the last quote. A review of Vic SES invoicing protocols during declared operations will also be undertaken to prevent similar oversights during future emergencies. When the time comes, and as that review takes place, we'll be asking Vic SES to join us on the Country Hour to tell you more about that, because that seemed to be the key bit out of the discussion, is that there needs to be a better system. When we know more, we'll tell you more. But a big change. Those invoices now being paid. That is the news out of that story today. It's 10 past 12 here on the Country Hour. Warwick Long with you in studio in Shepparton today. There is one place I would rather be, and that would be at Lardner Park in Warragul, which we have broadcast from in the past. Picked up some great tools at Lardner Park in Warragul. Fiona Broom is actually out there today and can join you from Farm World, the Mega Field Day in Gippsland, and can join you now. Fiona, where are you? What are you doing?
G'day, Woz. Yeah, I am here at Lardner Park. We're just outside of Warragul, and I reckon this is the biggest field day I have ever seen. There's absolutely thousands of cars outside. The site is just enormous, and it's still fairly early in the morning, but there are already just thousands and thousands of people here. And I am standing with Craig Debnam, who's the CEO of Lardner Park. It's the 57th year on site. Is that right, Craig?
Yeah, correct. So 59 years of Gippsland Field Days, but 57 here at Lardner Park, yeah.
So this is massive. How many people come through every year?
Oh, look, we would typically get somewhere between 30 and 40,000 over the 3 days of the event. We're hoping for 50 this year. That'd be lovely. There's so much for people to come and see. So, yeah, we've got a great show for people and great weather as well. So, you know, there's really no reason not to come. Get out here and enjoy what we have put on.
It is pretty much a perfect autumn day today. Who's coming out? I came past about a dozen school buses out on site, and there's just thousands of cars out there. Who's actually coming out this weekend?
Yeah, so look, the local community, our demographic would pull from right across regional Victoria, this being one of the bigger field days in the national calendar. So right across regional Victoria, you know, the Western District, Central Districts, etc. But our prime demographic is clearly South Gippsland, Central Gippsland, West Gippsland, Latrobe Valley. So that's where most of our people come from. And I suppose from a school's perspective, we put an invitation out so that future farmers can come along to Farm World and really enjoy what the show has to offer. So Friday's an excursion day for all the local schools, and they get to come and really see what this massive event is all about.
So people from across the state, but obviously a big draw for people from the region. So are the offerings sort of focused towards what's produced in this region, or is it really general across all of agriculture?
Yeah, I think the easiest way to explain that is global brands bought in by local businesses. That's what you'll see here at Farm World. So some of the most successful multinational brands that come into the region in the agricultural space get represented by the local dealer. So our relationship is definitely with the manufacturer, but also with that local dealer, because when people make a purchase in farm equipment, they want to make sure they've got the backup and service that sits behind it. So global brands in a local environment. And then from the perspective of who comes to Farm World, local producers, local farmers, really looking at and showcasing what Gippsland has to offer. So it's a fantastic event for that.
It is a huge event, and it has been running, as you said, for about 60 years. How do you make this year different? What makes this year stand out from other years?
Yeah, great question. We're constantly innovating Farm World. So we're looking at the things that do really well, that patrons enjoy and exhibitors like to exhibit, but we're also constantly looking at other field days and other events and ways that we can entertain people. I mean, our new Village Green this year is a classic example of that. So we've got the Ball Pavilion set up with, I think, two whiskies, two gins, two vodkas, five breweries, four wineries, all local produce. So it's a showcase for those local producers. And then we put 6 hours of live music with local artists in there each day. So people can come along, sample, test and purchase, and then consume some while they enjoy a really relaxed hospitality zone where three different artists each day will get up and have a sing-along, and people can really get into it.
I have to say, I'm feeling the vibe. It is just a perfect, perfect day today. Ange Bailey is also here with me. Ange, you're the chair of Lardner Park. You're also a local farmer.
I am. Welcome to Farm World, Fiona. Yes, we have a dairy and a hydroponic tomato business just based out of Yarragon. And and I've been on the board at Lardner Park for a few years now, and just love Farm World. It's great pulling everybody together. All the hard work comes together, and to look around and see all the crowds. And I think it's great to see so many school buses, because that's part of what we want to do here is educate and expose our kids in the community to the benefits of agriculture and what it can bring.
These kids are tiny. They must be, what, grade one, I guess?
Yes, looking very little, but very cute in their bright yellow hats, Fiona.
So dairy, obviously a major industry in this part of West and South Gippsland, but also a covered horticulture. So you've got hydroponic tomatoes. Is that growing in this region as well?
Yes, it is. We have a very big undercover or protected cropping business just in Nilma with under the name of Flavorite, and they are doing great things in the protected cropping industry. So our tomatoes go straight to there and get shipped off all over Australia within hours of hitting the floor. So it's good. It's a growing industry. It gives you benefit for a lot less space required, but the output and the production is huge, so it's good. Yeah.
And how's your season going in dairy? We're coming up almost again to milk price season.
Yes, no, it's dairying is going really well. It's a very, very positive industry to be in. We have around the area there has been a lot of dairy farmers leave the industry, so if the price can hold and we can keep people farming in dairy, it would be great. I think the price is looking okay, but it's always an unknown until that opening price comes out.
And plenty of dairy farmers, I'm sure, coming through Lardner Park over the weekend.
Yes, well, like they say, if farmers are doing well, then local towns and communities do well. So Farm World, you know, a lot of dairy farmers will be out here looking to upgrade their equipment and to see all the best of the newest innovations in one spot to, you know, we're all a bit time poor. So that's something that Farm World really offers, is the ability to come out and have a look at all manner of new innovations. And we're all looking to sharpen our use of time.
Ange, thank you so much for your time, and Craig, thank you for your time. Woz, I'm going to go have a wander around. I think I might climb on some of this giant farm machinery that I'm seeing around here. It all looks really, really interesting and a great vibe here. Back to you, Woz.
Don't spend too much, Fiona. That big farm machinery is worth quite a lot of money. Thank you very much for crossing in, though, from Farm World. She has all the fun. And I'm jealous that I'm in the studio. It's 16 past 12 here on the Country Hour. And we'll stay with Fiona Broome right now, actually, because she brought you a story yesterday looking at the Victorian Parliament and governments across Australia as well, and how they're thinking about how to feed growing populations whilst protecting farmland. We were talking agri-hoods as part of that yesterday. You can read about that right now at abc.net.au/rural. But Dr. Rachel Carey is part of the University of Melbourne's Victorian Food Resilience Planning Project. She says more work is needed to strengthen protections for remaining farmland around Melbourne and regional cities, especially as they try and expand. She also says we need food ministers to tackle issues around food cost and access.
There's a whole range of pressures on the food system, particularly around urban areas, in the sense that most of our populations live in urban areas. And so how it is that we feed people in urban areas becomes a significant issue that we need to look at in the future. And food systems are under pressure, of course, from climate change, from declining supplies of all the natural resources that underpin food production, including land, water, fertilizers, and of course, most importantly, the increasing number of people who are unable to gain access to sufficient healthy and cultural appropriate food, primarily because they're unable to afford to do that. So the way forward here is to be developing integrated plans, integrated whole of government plans. So in Victoria, we should be developing an integrated food plan. We should have somebody within government who is clearly accountable for not just food supply, but whether Victorians have sufficient access to enough healthy and culturally appropriate food. So I would argue that we need a minister for food, for example, and that it should be clear what the accountabilities for that minister are. So it should be legislated with clear targets, and there should be monitoring against those targets, including loss of agricultural land, as well as how many people are currently food insecure.
Do you think we also need a food plan and a food minister at the federal level?
Absolutely. Yes, exactly. That should be mirrored at federal levels. The recent inquiry into food security in Australia did recommend that a national food plan is developed, and that there should be also a minister for food. But I think the key thing here is that we're going to need to legislate so that it's clear what the accountabilities are of any minister for food and of other ministers that take actions that influence the food system and that influence food security as well. And we should be setting clear targets and monitoring against those targets. I think that's a really important thing here. It's not just about developing a plan. It's about ensuring that that plan is developed in an appropriate way. That means that our goals are clearly for not just an economically profitable food system, but one that is environmentally sustainable. And that also, of course, means that we produce food in a way that ensures that future generations can also meet their food needs, and that the food we're producing is healthy, and that it's also equitable, so that everybody has access to sufficient food. So we need to be looking at all of these things: the right to sufficient, adequate, healthy and culturally appropriate food is a basic fundamental human right, but it's not a human right currently that governments in Australia can be held accountable for, because it hasn't been legislated in Australia or at state level. And so it's really important that we start to see access to food as a fundamental human right, and that we actually legislate for that.
That's Dr. Rachel Carey from the Victorian Food Resilience Planning Project speaking there with Fiona Broome. So we have Agriculture Minister, right? The Agriculture Minister, Federal Agriculture Minister, is going to join you on the program in about 20 minutes or so's time. But do we need food ministers? What do you think about that argument? You can let me know. Send a text 0467 842 722. You can give us a call to 1300 977 222. Hey, we're getting some breaking news this lunchtime as well around the Gippsland transmission lines, the lines that needed to be built to connect, electricity infrastructure to the grid across eastern Victoria. Just getting our details together on that, we will bring you that shortly on the Country Hour as well. So a lot happening this lunchtime, and it is coming up for you on the program. Let's talk about your tractor right now. On the program, though, what's the future for farm machinery? Will the trend of bigger and bigger continue, more expensive as well? Or will you see farmers running more smaller but autonomous units? It's a question farmers are starting to ponder at the moment as the cost of big new machinery continues to soar and tractor horsepower continues to march towards the 1,000 horsepower figure, which sounds insane to be talking about, really. Corbin Schuster, though, is a farmer at Freeling, north of Adelaide. He's been looking at this sort of stuff, and he had a chat to Angus Verley about that question that's in his mind.
In the last couple of days, there's been a bit of discussion online about just this progression of farm machinery and the trajectory of farm machinery. How, say, from 100 years ago, it was a small tractor without a cab, and it's progressively gotten larger and larger, and now we've seen the likes of John Deere release an 800 horsepower articulated tractor, and Case have released a 700 horsepower articulated tractor. And people are just asking, look, with the trajectory we're going on, how much larger can this machinery get? And I guess the driving force behind it all seems to be there's always one operator sitting in a seat, and farmers want that operator, whether it's themselves or an employee, to get as much done in a day as possible. And the machinery manufacturers are kind of cottoning onto that desire for the farmer to be as productive as possible with one person sitting in the operator's seat. And so the machinery's just gotten larger and larger. It's tractors have gotten heavier, they've gotten more horsepower. All this is kind of, it's all made machinery more expensive as well. But there was a bit of a discussion. There's been a lot of videos on, say, X or formerly Twitter of autonomous machinery creeping around. And that really changes the paradigm. If you take the requirement for an operator out of the seat, you don't need to worry about how much one person can get done in a day. And that kind of shifts the whole paradigm of making machinery larger and larger for that one operator. And I think we're almost at a fork in the road now, because the question is, how much larger can machinery get? Or the second question is, does it really need to go larger if there's never a requirement or no longer a requirement for an operator sitting in the seat?
And Corbin, you made the point or the argument that if there was a move to smaller autonomous machines, then production could be maybe more streamlined. So rather than the manufacturer is making everything from a 50 horsepower to an 800 horsepower tractor and everything in between, they could have a smaller range of those autonomous machines, and then a small farmer could buy one or two, and a big farmer could buy however many they needed?
Absolutely, yeah. And that's, I mean, look at the product lineups of I'll pick on John Deere because we run John Deere machinery, but John Deere's have got 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 series tractors, and within each of those series tractors there's various horsepower, basically all the way from 100 horsepower to now the 800 horsepower tractors. But if they were smaller, autonomous, I guess modular machines, you'd really only need to have one or two. They'd definitely be cheaper. And if you wanted to get more done, you'd just buy more of the modular tractors. If you have a smaller modular type of autonomous tractor, it kind of lowers the entry bar or entry level for some of these smaller starting off farmers to get into the market, I guess. It will be interesting to see where we go in the next 15 or 20 years, and especially with automation creeping in from other industries and farmers are becoming a little bit more open to the idea that maybe they don't need to be inside the tractor to be completing the task. So I reckon, it does open up the market and some research and development into smaller, more modular, autonomous tractors.
And I saw another argument being made in favour of the smaller autonomous gear, that if you've got multiple of them, when it comes to, say, sowing time, if you've got your one big tractor and you have a major breakdown and you could be shut down for weeks waiting for that tractor to be fixed. But if you're running multiple units, one breaks down, the others would keep going.
Yes, absolutely. It does allow a bit of redundancy where, if one or two break down, you've still got a couple that are still completing the job, and you're still ticking those jobs off the list, although at a slower pace until those other ones come back online. We've seen agriculture a progression from kind of one horse or one ox pulling a implement to teams of horses, and then to smaller tractors, and now we've got tractors with 600 or 700 horsepower. And who knows, we might flip the switch again and go back to a smaller operator, smaller autonomous machines, and then up to swarms of them almost. So we'll see what happens.
Hopefully an autonomous horse pulling it along. Fascinating discussion, though. That's Freeling farmer Corbin Schuster having a chat with Angus Verley about the future of farm machinery. Is it going to continue to get bigger, or is there more disruption coming to this space? I did mention breaking news on the Country Hour this lunchtime. Let's get to that right now. The government agency that's planning the route for transmission lines for offshore wind in Gippsland has ruled out putting the lines underground. This morning, VicGrid announced its study area for the new transmission infrastructure, which will be needed to connect new offshore wind projects to the electricity grid in eastern Victoria. Kira Bott is the chair of Better Transmission Gippsland and a farmer near Gifford. She says it's not the news they were hoping for.
There are a lot of landholders that are really disappointed. We knew it was coming, but we are disappointed with the announcement that it's going to be overhead. Basically, we're disappointed because we believe that underground is technically and economically feasible. We already know this because Star of the South were about to sign contracts with landholders to go underground. And there is a commercial offshore proponent investing millions of dollars that is prepared to go underground, knowing that they can still make profits. And they would not do this if they weren't going to make money.
Well, I guess as part of this release, VicGrid has put some numbers around overhead transmission lines versus underground. So they've said it's estimated that it would cost between $700 million to $1.5 billion to go overhead, but undergrounding the transmission lines would cost between $2 billion and $4.5 billion. That's quite a big difference.
So really, if you look at it closely, that difference is roughly around three times the amount of what overhead would cost. And it really depends on where that scale, the budget for overhead, comes in at and where it comes in at for underground as to how far apart they actually would be, with more details looking into it. But it's really important that we factor in the long-term costings of it. So looking at underground expenses over the next 30 years, we know that the cost for maintenance over that 30 years is significantly less than what it costs to maintain overhead lines. And with the climate heading the way it is, current research really does show that undergrounding is the way of the future. Technology has improved dramatically. The Powerlink study that's done by Curtin and Queensland universities was released just last November, and it highlights the improvements that have been made to make that technology more practical and more cost-effective.
So I guess one of the things with this, the difference in cost, you say it's about three times the amount to go underground that it is to have overhead lines. Those costs would be paid for by Victorian consumers, wouldn't they, as part of their, you know, as part of the network and the bills that they receive from their retailer. So wouldn't the entire community have to pay for something that I guess a handful of landholders would prefer?
So we're asking, you know, a group of landholders to sacrifice an awful lot for companies to make more money. So, you know, it's nice to say that, yes, this is going to be passed on to the consumers, but ultimately what we're doing is we're paving an easy road for international multi-million dollar companies to make huge profits. So why should our communities have to wear those costs? Why should our future generations have to wear those costs? It just doesn't seem like we're designing this energy for the future needs of our children and our future landholders. It seems like we're making this easy for mega multi-million dollar companies to make quicker and faster profits.
And just going back to the map that was released, which is the study area that VicGrid will look at when looking at finalising a route, do you know how many landholders are now affected by that region that's been released?
I think that's probably a better question for VicGrid. They know how many letters they've had to send out to affected landholders, but I definitely have had a lot of concern from a lot of community members that have reached out to Better Transmission Gippsland in the wake of receiving these letters. And I'm sure I haven't heard from everybody just yet, but VicGrid would have a better answer to that question for you.
So what now for your group? Now this has been released, VicGrid said they will consult. What's your next step?
Well, we're definitely not giving up on our mission to try and get things put underground. We are a very passionate group of people who are, we really have our hearts set on getting this underground for, you know, for both this generation and the next, and energy transmission that really coexists with the farmland that is also so precious to our area. And we really think this is possible because in Gippsland, there are already five precedents for putting transmission underground. Apart from Star of the South, which I've mentioned earlier, there's the diesel transmission, and that goes 87 kilometres underground. We also have the Bass Link that already have 8 kilometres of transmission that's put underground. The proposed Marinus Link is 90 kilometres proposed to be underground. And also VicGrid themselves insist on the offshore providers to come into their collection hub underground.
That is Better Transmission Gippsland Chair Kira Bott speaking there to Emma Field. We've got a call in to VicGrid and we'll have an interview with them next week. Note, affected landholders were notified by VicGrid by mail. The ABC understands they got those letters this week. Rebecca's on the line, 1300 977 222 is our number here on the Country Hour from Bendigo. G'day, Rebecca.
Hello, how are you?
I'm good. What did you want to say?
I hope this line's okay because I'm in the car. Two things to Murray Watt. Firstly, I really think we need to get the Country Hour broadcast through our metropolitan ABC radio stations to educate consumers about production systems. But the second thing, please just ask him about foot rot vaccine that was available to the sheep industry 6 years ago. Australian researched, Australian manufactured, and our industry can't access it anymore. And I am asking, I've been on the phone to the Federal Ag Department and multiple others. We're making progress, but it's just a tool that we need in our toolkit.
Why can't you access it, Rebecca?
Well, look, there's a long history to it. 6 years ago, it was available, and it no longer is. You asked Murray what that. It's got to do with the APVMA, but we are, as an industry, looking for some funding. I was talking to Rob Barwell from Animal Health Australia yesterday, and everyone is keen to see it back in the hands of producers to provide effective foot rot control for sheep producers.
I've got to keep moving, Rebecca, but thank you so much for putting that on our list, because this is why we asked for talk back. I wouldn't have been asking that question without you. Thank you very much. Let's get to rural news now with Emma Field today. Hi, Emma.
Good afternoon, Warwick. It's hard to believe, but Houthi rebel pirates are holding up the access to jeans for ringers on remote cattle stations. The difficulty in the Red Sea has slowed delivery of popular jeans, and the phone is starting to ring off the hook for retailers. Claudia Fox, the founder of Shoot Nine Jeans, which are specifically made for girls working on the land, says she's been inundated by messages asking her when the next restock is due to make it ashore. She's resorted to undertaking the large expense of flying in stock to meet demand from remote properties.
It's frustrating having to come back to them with with the same response, and I feel like it's been going on for too long.
I didn't think I should be too stressed about the pirates, but probably more just because I hadn't been restocked for so long, and it's a big expense to fly them in, and I couldn't afford to get them sent all over, but I should do about a quarter of the shipment. So that is, I managed to get some on a plane and they were here within a week, and now I'm wishing I just wore it and shipped and air freighted the whole lot in.
The battle to buy Australia's largest ginning company, Namo Cotton, is heating up, with a second international ag giant putting in a bid to buy the company. Singapore-based Olam has announced a $122 million takeover offer. It comes after France-based Louis Dreyfus Company offered to buy Namo in November. Namo Cotton chairperson Tim Watson says the board has plenty to consider before closing a deal.
A non-binding indicative offer from Olam, 59 cent under a scheme of arrangement, or at 57 cents as a off-market takeover. The way the scheme of arrangement with Louis Dreyfus works, and with any takeover in the ASX space, the board has to at any stage consider a higher and better offer as to whether it's in the best interest of the shareholders. The board has to give it some consideration.
Drought-stricken King Island farmers are being supported by Lions Need for Feed charity, with 40 tonnes of pellets to be shipped over to the island next week. The drought on the island is the worst since the 1970s and is being compounded by challenges in getting feed and livestock to and from the mainland. Weather conditions have really dried off on King Island and mainland Tasmania, with most regions desperate for rain. The Northern Territory's Cattlemen's Association has elected a new president, with industry veteran Henry Burke taking over from David Connolly, who's finishing his three-year term. Mr. Burke is the current manager of Consolidated Pastoral's NT and WA's operations, and prior to that worked for AACo for more than three decades. Mr. Burke said there are some big issues facing the NT cattle industry.
Our upfront issues are always roads, bushfires. We've had a big bushfire year last year, and we're still working on that process to make sure that we're more prepared for it this year. We've got roads, it's a lot of damage for a big wet season that we've just had. We've got the class action ongoing from the live export. We've got regulations on the live export stuff that we're sort of dealing with. There's a whole range of things, and obviously the priorities keep coming up to the front and try and knock them over as much as we can, or particularly get decisions on that so we can move on from them.
A new book exploring and celebrating the history of wine in Australia has been released, nearly 18 years after it was started. The Australian Ark is a three-volume work which starts way back in 1788 to the present-day wine industry. Author Andrew Kayard says the original plan was going to be a book written about the classic wines of Australia, but it just kept growing and now is so much more.
About 10 years ago, I kind of felt that that the Australian wine industry really needed to know its history. And that would be a very useful thing to write a book on the history of Australian wine. So the book that I actually started previously to that is actually incorporated into the book, because we have a whole list of the classic wines of Australia going back to 1792 all the way up to 2021. I suppose one of the main things is to say is that this is an unusual book in that it's been published as a not-for-profit publication. Anyone who buys the book will be pleased with what they've got, because not only is it a good read, but it makes damn good doorstop as well when they're finished with it.
And that wraps up Rural News.
You always want to have a book that makes a good doorstop, especially with the author using that as a reason to buy it. Love it. Thanks very much, Emma Field there with Rural News. The Agriculture Minister's on the way right now, though. Let's find out what's happening weather-wise around our state with Stephanie Miles from the Bureau. Hi, Stephanie.
Hi, Warwick. How are you?
I'm good. How's it looking today and for the weekend and next week?
Sure. Look, another gorgeous day across the state today. It's definitely feeling just like it did yesterday with those minimum temperatures reaching some of the coldest that we've had for the start of the year. We had some fog around in the very southern parts and again over the mountains as well, but otherwise it's a beautiful sunny day today. We've got some cloud developing in the southern parts, but those maximum temperatures really just persisting around the mid to high 20s. And all of this weather is coming from us being under a high pressure system, and it's not really changing over the next, you know, 2 to 7 days, unfortunately. So we've got a very stable and consistent weather pattern happening. However, overnight tonight and into tomorrow morning, there will be a bit of cloud and showers developing in the southern parts of the state as the tail end of a cold front that's crossing Tasmania just clips the southern parts of our state. But then by tomorrow afternoon in the south in particular, a lot drier, and in the north remaining dry too. Now on Sunday it will be another sunny day, and then by Monday, our ridge kind of starts to build over us, which means we get some more east-west, west-east winds over the more southern parts. So perhaps there'll be some strong winds, particularly over Bass Strait and our coastal waters for the Sunday-Monday period. But by Tuesday, a couple of showers on the south of the ranges once again, and that continues Wednesday and Thursday. And those temperatures just continuing to be in the mid to high 20s. So look, a really nice settled week ahead if you've got a couple of showers in the south, sunshine in the north, and those temperatures mid to high 20s, Warwick.
And warnings-wise across the weekend, Stephanie, is there anything I need to be aware of or keeping an eye out for there?
No warnings in particular. I guess on the Sunday, Monday, there's a chance that we could see those strong wind warnings over the coastal waters. But other than that, no warnings for any severe weather. There is a chance that you could see some smoke on the horizon. There's a lot of planned burns going on with the CFA and the Forest Fire Management at the moment. So if you see some smoke, just check on the Vic Emergency app to see what's going on. But otherwise, all looking good out there, Warwick.
Any major rain on the radar at all?
Yeah, good question. I know yesterday we spoke about whether or not that tropical cyclone from the north or ex-tropical cyclone will impact us. But at the moment, I'm still so much uncertainty on whether the rainfall is going to get us. Very much just look towards the Easter weekend. Hopefully we can get a straight story for you by Monday next week.
Stephanie, thanks very much for the update and have a great weekend.
You too, Warwick. Thanks so much.
Stephanie Miles, Senior Forecaster at the Bureau of Meteorology, taking you through the full forecast there. You're listening to The Country Hour. Warwick Long with you on the program. Also being joined by the Agriculture Minister, Murray Watt, the Federal Agriculture Minister, in the state today to meet with the dairy industry to look at its future and its state of play as well. And he can join you to tell you all about it right now. Murray Watt, welcome back to The Country Hour.
G'day, Warwick. Good to be with you.
Tell me about this dairy meeting. We weren't allowed to go, which made me sad.
Really? But
tell me all about it. What are you looking at with the dairy industry today?
We would have loved to have had you there, Warwick, because I know you've got a real interest in this topic. We actually went to the last federal election with a commitment to hold a dairy symposium at some point over the course of this term, and that's what we've been doing today here in Melbourne. I think everyone understands that dairy has a really long history in this country. In fact, as you may have heard, my father actually grew up on a dairy farm just outside Mackay in North Queensland. And it has a very strong history, still a really big contributor to our national economy. But obviously, it's an industry that's had some challenges. You know, it's still the third biggest agricultural industry in Australia. And it was really pleasing to see recently Rabobank put out some figures that showed that our production of milk has increased basically between about July last year and January this year. And that is encouraging because one of the challenges the industry is dealing with is a shrinking milk pool. We have lost a lot of dairy farmers from the country over recent decades. And, you know, that has issues for our food security, but also for all of those jobs that we have across Victoria and the country in processing. So today what we've done is pull together probably about 80 or so representatives from the industry. We've got farmer representatives, processors, the unions who represent workers in the industry, researchers, And there's been some really good discussions about how we can stabilise this industry and actually get it going forward again.
Yeah, and you're right. It's an interesting time for the industry. That had been sort of falling in production levels for a really long period of time. And then the green shoots, to use the economic parlance, of the Rabobank report, the Dairy Australia numbers showing a turnaround in what's being produced. Your department and yourself are being presented with numbers from Dairy Australia today looking at, well, what are the scenarios for the industry? Do you have confidence that you can stop the decline of the dairy industry and it can find its feet in Australia?
Yeah, I do, Warwick, and I think we just have to. I don't think it's a matter of choice. I think we've got to stop the slide of the industry. There is too much riding on it for it to go that way. And you're right, that green shoots phrase was used a couple of times this morning, and I think people are optimistic that we may be turning a corner. You know, as I say, it's the dairy industry is a really important contributor to our nutrition, our food security. It's the backbone of lots of regional communities around Australia, especially in Victoria. And I think it's really important to keep that industry going strong. You know, it's going to be a different kind of industry. There was a lot of discussion today about the consolidation we've seen in the industry, as we have with agriculture across the board. And also, you know, how can we be tapping some of those export opportunities that are growing in markets both in Asia and the UK and other countries? It's one of the good things that's come out of some of those trade agreements that we've been able to strike. So the UK, for instance, a really good and big market, is dropping its tariffs on dairy exports from Australia under that trade agreement. You would have seen recently we had the ASEAN leaders from Southeast Asia in Melbourne. There's real interest in our dairy exports. And in fact, as part of that, I took the Vietnamese agriculture minister out to Agriculture Victoria's R&D dairy farm at Ellenbank. So, you know, it's not just about exporting the milk and the cheese, the products. It's also about how we can export some of that technology and know-how that we've developed as well.
And you said around 80 people in the room, you would have 80 different ideas and thoughts on the dairy industry code, mandatory code, and how it's working and how or if it could be improved. You've actually made an announcement today about the dates and the timeline for a review of the dairy code. What have you decided?
Yeah, that's right. And you got it right, Warwick. There's a lot of different opinions in the dairy industry, as there are in the agriculture sector generally. What we've said today, we had already announced that we would push back the end date for the second review of the dairy code back to the end of 2026. Your listeners might remember the first review of the dairy code happened actually before we took office. And I guess our thinking was that we just needed a little bit of time to allow the recommendations from the first review to take effect, see how they were going out before we just barged into another review all over again. But having said that, we're conscious that there are a number of people who've got issues with the current code. And what we've said today is that we will commence the consultation on that review in September this year. But the review itself won't finish until the end of 2026, but we do want to get starting to think about some of those issues that people are raising, and people have an opportunity to be involved at that point.
That largely adds certainty, though, because until the season starting in the financial year of 2027, farmers will largely be working under the code as it stands. That's right.
That's right. And I think, you know, to generalise, the feedback that I've been receiving from farmers, dairy farmers, is pretty positive about the code. And you will have seen, you know, that ABARES has put out figures showing that in the last couple of years, dairy farmers on average have been earning much better incomes than they had before. And there's certainly an argument that that's partly because of the code. But equally, the processors, you know, have some concerns about it. And, you know, that they're under increasing cost pressures themselves. So I think we do, you know, it's worth having a bit of a look at, but not rushing it, because as I say, it's not that long since the first review was completed and we want to see how those recommendations go as well.
I want to ask you about a couple of other things that our listeners have put on the menu. But just before we do that, you're giving money to Dairy Australia to look at growing the milk pool. How will that work? What are you looking at here?
Yeah, that's right. So the discussion we've had this morning, Warwick, has been focused on how we can lift the productivity of the dairy sector so that it can continue to grow. You know, obviously, we've all got an interest in making sure that dairy farmers, dairy processors remain profitable going forward. But the reality is that, you know, at the moment, with all those international pressures, we are seeing costs rise as well. So the way someone described it is that productivity is what sort of squares the circle between remaining profitable and managing your costs. The dairy industry, just like a lot of our agricultural sector, its productivity performance hasn't been so strong in recent years. There were some really good ideas put forward by people today about how we can lift that productivity. Things like, you know, increasing the skills, you know, attracting more workers and higher skilled workers. In particular, there's a lot of interest about how we can be adopting and extending new R&D and technology into this sector. There's obviously a lot of interest about lifting the dairy sector's sustainability further, and that can actually play a positive role in lifting profits and reducing costs. And what we've said is that we're going to provide some funds to Dairy Australia so that they can pick up some of these ideas that have come forward today, flesh them out a bit with some more workshops with industry, and start thinking about how we can increase the size of the milk pool and how we can increase the productivity of the industry generally.
How much money are you giving them to do this?
It's in the hundreds of thousands, Warwick. I don't have the exact figure on me, but I know it's in the hundreds of thousands. And, I mean, the reason for that is that we've all gone along to forums and workshops where everyone has a bit of a say and nothing ever goes anywhere. We don't want this to be a talk fest. This is about, today it's really about flushing out some ideas, and now we can have those workshops facilitated by Dairy Australia and the department to work them up.
A couple of questions without notice, really, from our audience, which I'm sure you would love, Agriculture Minister Murray Watt with you on the Country Hour. But Rebecca from Bendigo just rang before about access to a foot rot vaccine for sheep farmers, saying 6 years ago there was this access, but now they've got difficulties. It was Australian produced, this vaccine, and she wants to make sure it's on your radar as something that you could advocate for her industry. Do you know much about this, or could you find out for Rebecca and come back on our program?
Yeah, to be honest, Warwick, I haven't heard that one before. It's one of the reasons I love coming on the Country Hour. I always learn something new. And so Rebecca, I haven't had that raised with me before, but I'll get our department onto it. There may be a good reason for that. I'm not sure, but we'll certainly chase that down for you. And happy to come back to you, Warwick, if you want to relay it on the radio.
That would be wonderful. Kimberly, one of our ABC reporters who I spoke to coming back from Bali at the height of the fear of foot and mouth disease and its ability to get on a plane and come to Australia, which I know you and I spoke to a lot about at the time.
We did.
And she sent me all the photos from the Melbourne airport just this week, and showing a lot more access to foot baths, a lot more signage, and a lot more declaration notices there for Australians traveling back from Bali. So it looks like that is continuing. Is that still a major focus for you?
Yeah, it is. And I'm pleased to see that Kimberly has seen some of that signage and the foot mats and all those kind of things that we've done. Yeah, I mean, I remember us talking about this at the time, Warwick, and it was a massive scare for our livestock industry, our dairy industry, even our grains industry, given they provide a lot of the feed for livestock in Australia. It's a real credit to everyone involved, whether it be governments, individual farmers, industry, the workers in the industry, that we've managed to keep FMD out of the country. We've obviously also put a lot of work into keeping lumpy skin disease out and a range of other, you know, crop-based diseases too. It's one of the reasons why last year in the budget we significantly increased funding for biosecurity funding. I was pretty horrified when I became the minister to learn that the biosecurity budget that we inherited from the former government was actually on track to fall at a time when we actually face more threats. So we've corrected that by putting a lot more taxpayer funding in, increasing charges on importers, and of course we're in the process of introducing a very small levy on producers as well, as part of that effort to increase our biosecurity services.
That's not a short of passing though, is it, that levy? That's been fought pretty hard right now from industry.
Yeah, I mean, no piece of legislation is ever assured of passing, but it's passed through the House of Representatives this week, and obviously there'll now be consideration by the Senate. And look, you know, I'm fully aware that producers aren't particularly thrilled about the idea of paying that levy, but I guess my perspective was that I was prepared to go into the cabinet and fight for a big increase in taxpayer funding for biosecurity, and we've done that. As I say, we've significantly increased the charges on importers who create a lot of the risk. Again, something the former government hadn't done. But when you think about it, if we're going to be asking, you know, the shopkeeper, the teacher, the nurse, the tractor driver in Shepparton or any other regional town to pay a bit more for biosecurity. I think farmers have got an interest in doing so as well.
If you don't get that passed, is that going to make it difficult to continue to fund things like the footpaths that are there for barley travellers at the moment?
Well, I mean, we would obviously do everything we possibly can to fund those kind of things because they're important to do. But, you know, I think that the more that we can be spending on biosecurity, the better those protections will be and the more safe our farmers' livelihoods will be. So, you know, I think farmers, probably more than anyone, have got an interest in having really strong biosecurity in this country. And that's why we've sort of taken the view that there's a shared responsibility. We've all got a role to play in keeping diseases out. We've all got a role to play in funding our biosecurity system. And I want to make sure that our biosecurity system in Australia remains the envy of the world, which I think it currently is.
And just before we finish up, Murray Watt, you're a Queenslander, your Queensland colleague, Jim Chalmers, will be putting together a federal budget soon. Is there any idea of major funding announcements or money we should be looking out for in the federal budget?
Well, I'd probably be losing my job, Warwick, if I leaked too much at this point in time. But I'm obviously working closely with Jim and the Prime Minister and Katie Gallagher, the Finance Minister, on the budget over the next few weeks. You know, I think people would be aware that some of the priorities that I've been putting forward ever since becoming the Minister, you know, biosecurity, sustainability, workforce, trade, they're the kind of things that I'm keen to secure some more funds on. But it's a pretty competitive environment. Everyone needs more money to do things in their portfolios, but I'll be fighting hard for agriculture as much as I can.
It was worth a shot. Murray Watt, thanks for your time.
Absolutely. Good on you, Warwick.
Murray Watt there, Federal Agriculture Minister, speaking to you on a number of issues, mainly dairy, because the Dairy Symposium is on today in Melbourne. A lot about the future of that industry, but the review of the Dairy Code going to be later now. That date has been pushed out, but also Money for Dairy Australia to undertake a look at trying to grow the milk pool. Many of you having your say on that. I'll get to that if I have time in the end. It is the end of the program, though. Well, coming towards the end of the program, we love having market information for you at the end of the country. No livestock markets today, so let's talk our way through what's happening in the market. Many growers are seeing wild fluctuations between different markets at the moment. Yesterday, the Wagga Wagga sheep and lamb market jumped, with some pens making $25 a head more than the previous week, but that's anything but consistent in the picture across sale yards in Victoria and New South Wales. Wimmera manager for AWN, Wayne Driscoll, was asked to explain what's going on.
Look, a lot of it's to do with the positions that some of these abattoirs hold. And, we've got some of the bigger, well-maintained ones and well-handled ones that have got, backup plans and numbers booked up. And some of the medium to smaller operators have been going hand to mouth. And yesterday was a clear indicator of that when Wagga came out and was $25 dearer than what it's been. So there is a little bit of light, just don't know when it's going to come. Once these numbers clear and the actual backup to some of these bigger abattoirs is not there, who knows what the market might do.
Okay, so some of the abs have kill space and others don't.
Well, some have just gone hand to mouth, and they've been able to win because they're, obviously they've been able to buy in a market where it's down, where some of the ones who have got kill space booked and potential contracts have paid a little bit over what a market position currently is. So, when it comes home to roost that there's nothing as a backup to some of those smaller ones, they've got to go into a market then and buy and actually buy and compete. And that's what our industry really wants, is buy and compete. So we might start seeing that shortly, and as some of these numbers start to deteriorate.
So that's your tip, that in the next couple of months we will see prices move in the right direction?
Yeah, it is. I still got a caveat on it. I don't know how long it's going to be exactly, but there's no doubt that we're going to fall off a cliff from a number point of view. You'll just see this step in overnight. So, and look, they do know it. There's no doubt about that. A lot of the abattoirs do know that, but no one can really put a handle on exactly when that's going to be.
The sheep side of things, Wayne, not too flash at the moment?
No, look, heavy sheep have just this week been battered around a little bit in most centres, so that's been interesting, but a couple of major ones, particularly the Northern Dubbo one, didn't need any sheep for a few weeks. So that sort of knocked things about a little bit. But interestingly enough, there, another one that's come out and started showing forward contracts forward, which is unusual for the winter, so or late autumn. So that's encouraging, very encouraging. And once again, that's a numbers thing as well. So we can expect that to sort of improve as we go as well.
That's AWN Livestock Manager Wayne Driscoll speaking there with Angus Verley. Some of your reviews on texts of the Agriculture Minister just before we finish up on the Country Hour today. This one saying, how can the Minister not know how much money he's given to Dairy Australia when he's been there? And how does the Minister not know about the foot rot vaccine? It's useless. Total spin, says this text. So this one from Bernard saying, just more talk by people in suits about research, skills, productivity. It goes on and on. The reality is it's all down to milk pricing. And right now, we finally have one that's starting to come close to making dairy farming viable again. The rest is a sideshow. And are we really being overpaid compared to other regions, says Bernard. A couple of other texts saying the federal minister more than happy to speak on the program, yet the state minister still remains missing in action, whilst major issues and concerns that will affect agriculture in our state remain unaddressed. The state minister needs to be shown the door or come on the Country Hour, says that text. Craig says, was got to listen to the Country Hour late. Got excited when I heard you said you'd be interviewing the agriculture minister. Thought it was going to be the Vic agriculture minister. Do we have a Vic Agriculture Minister? I never hear her on the Country Hour, says Craig. We do have requests in pretty much weekly. We are putting in requests, actually, more often than that, with the Victorian Agriculture Minister, Ros Spence. Unavailable so far to talk to you. We will continue to do it on your behalf. But thank you for your commentary and your thoughts on the text line today, as always, on the program.